This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. No attorney general of the United States has ever had what you'd call an easy job. But Merrick Garland's brief is maybe something else. Donald Trump tried his hardest to make the Justice Department into his personal legal team. So Garland now has to reestablish independence at the agency, but he can't exactly avoid politics. He has to decide, for example, how to prosecute the January 6 rioters who tried to overturn the election results. He also has to figure out how prosecutors should handle Trump officials who may have broken the law. He can hardly avoid the current legal battle over abortion that's engulfed the country. Merrick Garland spoke with The New Yorker's Jane Mayer last week as part of the New Yorker Festival.
So you've been in this job now for more than 6 months, after having spent 25 years at your previous job. How do you like it? And how does it compare?
Well, you're right. I seem to spend a long time in my jobs. I think we can be assured I will not be spending 25 years in this one. One of the things I gave up was life tenure. I loved being a judge. I really did. But I love this job as well. There are definitely differences. Some of the advantages of this job are I no longer am barred from issuing advisory opinions, which I could not do as a judge. And now I could do 6 advisory opinions before breakfast. Nobody stops me. The other thing, and quite important, is that in the previous job, I had to wait until an important case or even an interesting case came before me. And now if I read something in the New Yorker online in the morning and it strikes me as the government's doing something wrong or the country's doing something wrong, or somebody should be protected, I can do something about it. And sometimes by the end of the day. So those are good things. There are some disadvantages, like that I'm on the wrong side of lawsuits, the wrong side of the V, my name. I miss my judicial immunity.
But so you're being sued, like, basically every day.
I get sued quite a lot. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. But in the end, judges and attorneys general have the same bottom line requirement. We're obligated to uphold the rule of law and to be sure that equal justice under law is done. So in those ways, the jobs are very similar.
Well, listening to you talk about how you miss immunity brings up the something we would all like. But it is actually something that the former president said that he had while he was in office. And one of the first questions I had for you was because the Twitterverse is very much alive with people who are on fire about the need to go after the former president and hold him accountable for things that he did in office when he was in office, now that he's out. And it's not just the Twitterverse. There are a number of critics, and even your former law professor, Lawrence Tribe, mm-hmm. wrote a column, and he said that he thought that Trump should be prosecuted for his role in setting off the insurrection, and that he should be prosecuted for inciting insurrection and seditious conspiracy. Now, I know that you can't really talk about cases that are ongoing, but it did make me wonder whether you worry that by going after the foot soldiers and not the commander in chief, there may be a kind of a dangerous message being sent that there's no accountability in high places, and that others may, sort of try to copy what happened before on January 6th. So how do you see that issue?
Well, like I've said many times before, January 6th was a heinous event, which almost interfered with the cornerstone of our democracy, which is the peaceful transfer of power from one administration to another. We have taken actions commensurate with how important this act was. So we have every U.S. Attorney's office in the country. We have every FBI office, I think, except maybe Puerto Rico, has been involved in investigating this and making arrests. We've brought in U.S. attorneys from all over the country to be detailed to the U.S. Attorney's office in Washington, which is the center of our investigation. We've already charged more than 600 people. We've gotten terabytes of information from citizen sleuths all over the country who've noticed someone that they recognize or been able to match with other pictures. We are doing everything we can to ensure that the perpetrators of January 6th are brought to justice. My very first thing that I did when I came to the Justice Department, very first day, was to go to the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. to discuss where the investigation is and where it's going. Every single week, I get briefed by the FBI director, the Deputy Attorney General, as to where this investigation is going. We will follow the facts and the law wherever they lead. I'm not, as you're quite right, I'm not able to talk about any particular individuals or particular investigations. There's a longstanding policy of the Justice Department. It's an element of the rule of law. It's very good reason why we follow that policy.
What would you, if there's criticism that too many of the kind of the foot soldiers are being prosecuted, and maybe there's actually also been some criticism even from a couple judges that the charges being brought against them are misdemeanors and maybe not as serious as they could be. What would you say to people who are making those criticisms?
The prosecutors involved in this case are making determinations in every case about what charge fits the offense, what charge fits the law. I am quite aware that there are people who are criticizing us for not prosecuting sufficiently, and others who are complaining that we are prosecuting too harshly. This is, part of the territory for any prosecutor in any case. I have great confidence in the prosecutors who are doing these cases. They are committed to pursuing them until they find an answer and to making sure that the prosecution's charges and ultimate sentences fit the offenses.
I wanted to ask you about another subject that I know that has been really important to you, which is voting rights, vote and elections. Mm-hmm. You've made, a very impassioned speech about the importance of voting rights and shown that you want to make this a priority to defend them. But yet the Supreme Court's been cutting off, it seems like, every avenue to enforce the Voting Rights Act. So I wondered, what really can the Justice Department do to ensure voting rights, to fight voter suppression, and to also fight election subversion, which is what people are beginning to talk about more as a threat moving forward?
Yeah. So I do feel deeply impassioned about this. This was the purpose of the Justice Department, founded during Reconstruction by President Grant for the purpose of protecting the right to vote of African Americans in the South during Reconstruction. The Voting Rights Act in 1965 was maybe the most important piece of legislation to ensure that there would not be discrimination in procedures and practices involving voting. That act gave the Justice Department powers, particularly Section 5, which required pre-clearance of changes in covered jurisdictions of practices and procedures. Now, you are right that in the Shelby County case, the Supreme Court effectively eliminated Section 5, throwing us back to where we were before the Voting Rights Act with respect to the requirement to go after individual cases. We're left with Section 2 questions, which also prohibit violations, discriminatory procedures in that regard. Then in the Brnovich case, the Supreme Court again narrowed what right. we have under Section 2. So the premise of your question, which is, are our tools weakened? Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. But our passion hasn't weakened. The Voting Rights Section and the Civil Rights Division as a whole, it was greatly depleted previously when I got here. So one of the first things we did was insist upon doubling the size of the voting section. And we have used Section 2 to bring actions. This is what we did in Georgia. We are seriously and urgently investigating and examining other changes in procedures and practices, and particularly looking at all the redistricting that's done as a consequence of the decennial census. But again, I think we need Congress to help here. We need a change. We need a legislation to give us back authorities that we need in order to do this.
Into another hot topic of the topic of abortion. the Justice Department weighed in on the Texas state law, SB 8. It was clearly crafted with the intention of avoiding judicial review, and yet you jumped in, and I'm just curious, how did you see that issue, and why do you think it was important for the DOJ to get in there?
Well, I think we saw it in the way the premise of your question put it. You know, our job at the Justice Department is to protect the Constitution and to protect the constitutional rights of Americans. They've deputized any person in the United States, whether they're in Texas or not, whether they have any relationship with the woman or not, whether they have any injury or other connection or not, to bring a case when that Texas law is violated or is attempted to be violated, and receive at least $10,000 in bounty. This is not only obviously intended, but expressly intended to prevent judicial review of an unconstitutional statute. And because clinics are not willing to risk or unable to risk the financial costs that will occur if they go forward, they have stopped providing services. So women are both unable to provide, get services and unable to get judicial review of an unconstitutional statute at the time they need the services. Every American should be worried about this, regardless of your party and regardless of your politics, because this can easily be a model for any constitutional right, not just the right we're talking about. It can be pursued by any state and not just Texas. And it doesn't take long to think about what the consequences for American democracy are if states start deputizing private bounty hunters to prevent citizens from exercising their constitutional rights. So when the Supreme Court declined to stop the case and the private case was brought, we felt it was our obligation to jump in immediately afterwards. It was a week afterwards, and to bring our own case.
Are you fairly confident you'll win on this?
We are confident. We brought a case that is well established in the law. We brought the case directly against Texas and against its officers, including judges, and including against anyone who is purporting to be deputized on behalf of the state. And we believe that is well-founded in the law.
There is another area that I think that I gather is something that you care a lot about, and that is the antitrust area. And I wanted to ask you about that. I read that antitrust was your favorite subject in law school. It sounds very dry, but I guess I'd love to know why. And I think what many people want to know is, I mean, at this point, there's sort of a growing feeling of concern, worry about the power of the big tech companies in this country, and people are trying to figure out what to do about that. And I wonder if you see the big tech sector is in your sights or in the sights of the antitrust division, basically.
Well, you're right. I have said it was my first love in law school. I think this is because I had a great industrial organization economics professor in my last year in college, and because I worked for some really great antitrust giants, both in my legal practice in the Justice Department and in law school. When I came in, just as was the case in the Civil Rights Division, the Antitrust Division was seriously depleted in terms of resources and personnel. So the first thing we did, and is in our request to the Congress for the FY22 budget, is to greatly increase the budget. And particularly with respect to personnel, we hope to increase the division by 90 personnel.
You're adding 90 people to the antitrust division?
If we get the money from the Congress,
uh-huh.
Yes, let me be
Are
clear about that.
Are they likely to support that?
Yes, I think so.
I
think they're, I spoke at the budget hearing. I was attacked for many things, but not for the suggestion. For that suggestion.
Well, it's kind of, there's bipartisan support to some extent for some of this, isn't there?
I think there is. Uh-huh. And, we've been off to a really strong start. We still, you asked about big tech. We have our the Google case, which was begun in the previous administration. It's being aggressively followed in this administration. We've been working on stopping mergers that would foreclose competition. We succeeded in stopping a merger of two of the three largest insurance brokerages. We just filed against what I call a quasi-merger between American Airlines and JetBlue. We've brought both civil and criminal cases in efforts of companies to foreclose wage competition and allocate markets with respect to the labor market. We have ongoing matters involving everything from agriculture to banking to real estate. So we're the antitrust division is energized and eager to go forward, and we do think that ensuring fair competition is an essential element of our obligation to ensure that justice is done.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General, so much for giving us your time.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
Attorney General Merrick Garland speaking with staff writer Jane Mayer at the New Yorker Festival last week. Now, an important update. After they spoke, after the interview, a federal judge issued a ruling that temporarily blocks the Texas abortion law, and that's in response to the suit brought by the Department of Justice. Garland called that a victory for women in Texas and for the rule of law. The state of Texas has appealed. You can find out more about the New Yorker Festival at newyorker.com/festival. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
When Creative Time, a public art organization, decided to place an exhibit inside the Domino Sugar Refinery, it tapped artist Kara Walker. When she saw this 30,000 square foot space, she decided to reach into the building's past.
Since coming to prominence, the artist Kara Walker has asked us to deal with some of the most insidious parts of our history. Walker became famous with paper cutouts in a style that seemed Victorian. She borrowed racist imagery from a past century to explore race, gender, violence, and power in our own time. But while the imagery may be painful, Walker's work is also seductive, beautifully realized in forms that are uniquely her own. She joined us last week at the New Yorker Festival for a conversation with Thelma Golden, the director and chief curator of the Studio Museum in Harlem. They discussed a work from a few years back, truly one of a kind, with the title A Subtlety, or The Marvelous Sugar Baby. It's a sphinx made in sugar constructed in a former sugar plant in Brooklyn. It was 75 feet long, really monumental. And as the sugar fermented, the smell also became monumental. The line to see the work was sometimes hours long. Here's Thelma Golden with Kara Walker.
So The Marvelous Sugar Baby very much seems to be a work on one hand, which calls into a moment that I think you have been in for some years, which is really intersects with the conversation in this moment about monument making, right? So that your work seemed to be in some ways responding to the effort towards monument, but in many ways creating a corrective in them, but also a subtlety also feels as if it's a work that really also talks about this relationship that you have through your work with audience. So could you talk a bit about that work in process as it relates to its form, but also its reception?
Yeah, I mean, the process was arduous. It was long. My brain doesn't work the way I want it to when I need it to do things. There's drawing, there's crying, there's reading, there's writing. And I was making PowerPoints that confused people that helped my mind sort of accumulate images and ideas and feelings. And ultimately, I realized, okay, it is really about the public. It is about creating a space that, you know, where I can, you know, sort of take these ideas about slavery, about the New World, about sugar, about the 1,000 years prior to the New World's discovery, where sugar was a refined, you know, treat for only the most special, you know, a very hard to get treat, all the way into the sort of economics of slavery, the hardships of the sugar plantation, the botany of the sugar cane, you know, and how to distill that or literally refine it into a something that is iconic and easily digestible, but also speaks about the sort of destruction of humanity that this beautiful substance, tasty substance, has come to represent and has come to be. And I thought, well, I actually have to think like the Havemeyer brothers. You know, I actually have to think about, like, I have a sugar refinery. How do I entice, you know, and repel at once? So, yeah, ultimately, I started thinking about the Sphinx. I started thinking about tourist attractions. I started thinking about ruins and ruins and ruins and past civilizations and that this place, this plant was about to be destroyed. It was emblematic of a past civilization that we are soon no longer to be a part of.
And you spent some time there watching the audience engage with that work.
Yeah, it was a big audience. I think they had 130,000 people over 6 weekends or something crazy lines. And I went a few times just to be there and see it, because it was the thing to be seen, and I couldn't believe that I was responsible for it, because people had so many varied and amazing responses to the work, tears and worship and, you know, selfies and, you know, rudeness and, you know, tasting, and, you know, it was really a sensory experience.
Really digging into this idea of monuments, I'd love for you to talk about what it meant to grow up in the literal shadow of Stone Mountain.
Well, Stone Mountain, just briefly, is, you know, we moved from Decatur to Stone Mountain when I was 15. And the first thing that happened was we got a notice, well, an American flag and a notice in our mailbox about the Klan rally down on Memorial Drive. This was in 1985. Because the Klan at that time still owned a part of the land that Stone Mountain Park is, that is, you know, occupied by the park. So at the time that I moved there, I was not really keen on visiting the park, but it was there and it was a destination for, you know, everybody in my school and neighborhood. And it's been this looming, strange, permanent artifact that I've learned more and more about over the last, you know, 25 years, I guess.
You've been making art since you were a child, but I want to know when you thought you were an artist. When did the idea occur to you?
Right. I mean, it's funny because I think, yes, I always kind of thought of, I have my father as a painter. I thought, you know, I spent around a lot of time as a child around people who said they were artists. So I just thought I was an artist, but I didn't really realize that I wasn't an artist until I was in graduate school. And I started to sort of, you know, really take stock of my own privilege in a way, the privilege of, you know, being around artists. And I thought, well, I want my work to have meaning. I want my work to have to have reach. I want my work to have range. And the work that I was looking at that I really thought that really spoke to me was work that hit a very hard note, you know, that talked about history, the German expressionists, for, you know, just the easy example. But there were other artists. I mean, certainly the work in the Black Arts Movement, you know, was really going hard at, you know, trying to right the wrongs of, you know, our history and of, you know, to really sort of mine plumb the depths of one's, you know, personal experience, but as it relates to social experiences, social history. But I think I had to grow up into that, you know.
You, through your imagination and this engagement in history, have created for many an alternative narrative, right? And so much of your work, Tara, for me, has been about the way in which you've taken a personal path through an imagining of perhaps the stories we haven't heard or the ways in which perhaps they might not have been told. Can you talk about this role of narrative in your work?
Sure. I mean, I think, again, sort of talking about influences and narrative, you know, kind of trying to understand where narratives of Black womanhood exist. They're primarily, you know, at least in the past, in the form of, you know, personal, you know, slave narratives and narratives of overcoming hardship or trying to overcome hardship. And so the truth, the sort of documentary, the personal documentary, the biography, the autobiography. And within the autobiography, I guess there's this kind of the problem of audience. In the course of autobiography, you have unsavory elements that maybe an audience of good Christian abolitionists doesn't exactly want to hear, so then euphemism becomes key, or, you know, a strong euphemism, but a key euphemism about rape, about a kind of strange and complicit feeling of complicity that perhaps the narrator is trying to wrestle with. Right? How did I wind up in this situation I was trying to protect my children, you know, or I was trying to set my children free or whatever. But there's a complexity, I think, to, you know, the experience of a woman in slavery that is harder to narrate. And that space is very interesting, the space of what's unspoken, what's unsaid, because it is both unsayable and very familiar. You know, just thinking abstractly, that's where the silhouette or the sort of as a blank space kind of becomes a representative of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And can you talk a little bit about what led you to the silhouette as a form?
It was the blank space, really. I was thinking a lot about, you know, part about the blank spaces within these narratives and thinking about my own sort of heart and sort of the stuff that I'm kind of made up of. I was really thinking about the sort of compression of stereotypes and ideas and misrepresentations coming from outside of me that were sort of building, and thinking, you know, just part of it was an abstraction. Part of it was thinking about Blackness, thinking about skin, thinking about that being a covering rather than an identity. And of course, you know, I was looking at a lot of historical imagery. I was thinking about identity, and I was thinking about my own growth, but I was also linking it with the sort of identity of America. Like, what is its representation? What does it look like? And I thought it also looks like this kind of blank space.
You know, in so many ways, you mine, right, the horror of what we know is the legacy of slavery, of racism, the violence of it. Can you talk about that part of your process and your practice, what it means to be mining such complexity in the work visually and through language and text?
I should be able to talk about it by now, but I think as far as part of the process, there is a, you know, an aspect that just feels necessary. You know, I think that mining my own depths, I dare say I've been accused in my childhood and other parts of my life of being too self-revelatory, of, say, seeing the wrong thing in a joking way that is, you know, self-deprecating to a fault or too revealing, or revealing in a way that upsets the group. So I did, I think at some point, stop talking. But it shows up in the work, sometimes without my even realizing it.
Well, I think there's a prescience to the work. You know, in the past moment you said, my work is all about the now. And it seems to me that even when your work is cited in these historic moments, that you are often commenting about what happens in the present.
Exactly. I mean, I think that what I set out to do in a way worked too well, which is to say, well, if I pretty everything up with hoop skirts and Southern bells, then nobody will recognize, you know, that I'm talking about them. And then they didn't, you know, they said, oh, this is, the past is so bad and I'm not from the past, you know, even if I make drawing that, you know, suggest that, you know, this is what I could have, you know, had access to, you know, like stylistically or something. It's not the case. I do live here now. And so do you.
When I have encountered your drawings, I always think of the amazing Audre Lorde quote, which she said of herself, I am my best work, a series of roadmaps, reports, recipes, doodles, and prayers from the front lines. It feels to me your drawing practice is somehow embedded and engaged in that idea, that it forms the connective tissue between past work and present work. Can you talk specifically about this moment of lockdown and then the ongoing period and what that has meant for your work and particularly your drawing practice?
Yeah, I mean, drawing it's important to me just to know that I exist. I think it is the connective tissue between my mind and, you know, my feeling, my heart and the outside, you know, being able to sort of put it down on paper is really something that I feel is a blessing, a privilege, and, you know, and also a burden and a chore, you know, to have to, you know, remember to do it and, you know, not forget. And it's shocking and it surprises me every time that, you know, when a drawing feels good to me that I didn't have a thought. I didn't know that it was what was coming, but it makes perfect sense. So I've been doing a lot of sitting down, just very kind of basic, nice sheet of paper, pencils, watercolors, maybe some ink. And that's been keeping me going through this period of lockdown, through a lot of ups and downs, you know, emotionally, a lot of some losses, some tragedies, some high points here and there. But it's like the through line for me is being able to sit at my table, wherever my table happens to be, you know, and do some drawings.
The artist Kara Walker speaking with Thelma Golden of the Studio Museum. Walker's work is on exhibit in Chicago at the Disabled Museum. Their conversation was recorded at the New Yorker Festival, which is still going on. You can find out more at newyorker.com/festival. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. How's it going?
How are you?
So we're going to talk about my absolute favorite subject in the world.
Critters. You're such an animal person, right, David? You have so many pets.
Okay, I may not be an animal person exactly, but Susan Orlean most certainly is. Her books include a biography of Rin Tin Tin, as well as The Orchid Thief and The Library Book. Susan is also the author of a million great pieces in The New Yorker, some of which appear in her new collection of essays. The book is called Simply and Accurately on Animals. It includes a profile that ran in The New Yorker called Show Dog. So listen carefully, because Susan's opening here is pretty much unbeatable, though it does feature some language that is, let us say, polite only in dog circles.
If I were a bitch, I'd be in love with Biff Truesdale. Biff is perfect. He's friendly, good-looking, rich, famous, and in excellent physical condition. He almost never drools. He's not afraid of commitment. He wants children. Actually, he already has children and wants a lot more. He works hard and is a consummate professional, but he also knows how to have fun. What Biff likes most is food and sex. This makes him sound boorish, but he's not. He's just elemental. Food he likes even better than sex. His favorite things to eat are cookies, mints, and hotel soap. But he will eat just about anything.
I have to tell you, when I first read this, which is some time ago, I thought, and I think I'm right, that you were doing a lot of things at once. And one of them is a parody of the profile form of human beings. So tell me a little bit about this piece.
You know, I began my career, like many of us did, doing a lot of celebrity profiles. That was the grist of the mill of journalism in the magazine world. And they have a very formulaic quality. When I decided I wanted to profile a show dog, I thought of it almost as if I were being dispatched to profile Linda Evangelista. I mean, it's like, what is there a real person beneath the kind of layer upon layer of the posse that is there to make this thing stand as an article of perfection? I loved elevating the profile of the dog to that same degree of scrutiny and seriousness that you would apply to a person.
Well, I always talk about the gods of nonfiction providing, you know, actual facts becoming almost too good to be true. One of them begins with the name of the dog, Biff Truesdale. It's like the name of the star of a surfing movie in the 60s, like Troy Donahue or something like that.
I know. It's so funny. And the fact that it is such a human name. And I agree with you. I think the miracle of writing nonfiction is that facts are just so fantastic. And if I were writing a fictional profile of a dog, I wouldn't have the nerve to name him Biff Truesdale. I wouldn't have the nerve to have some of the elements or some of the quotes from the people around him, because they're just too fantastic and too funny.
Now, we've known each other for a long time. We used to have offices right next to each other, and I didn't really know this about you. In fact, I don't even think, certainly when you lived in the city full time, that you were that much of an animal nut. And here, what's happened is that a whole bunch of pieces have accumulated over time in The New Yorker and occasionally elsewhere on animals and your love for them. And let's just say I can't relate, but I love the book. So what's your history with animals? How did this turn out to be such a passion?
I always just found animals delightful. I liked looking at them. I liked interacting with them. I fantasized about being around them. I didn't have the desire to become a naturalist or somebody who was out in the woods, but I happen to have a real soft spot for working animals. That gives you a little bit of a tip-off where a lot of these stories come from, which is the place where animals and people actually work together.
What does that even mean?
I think wild animals are amazing and fascinating, but I'm more interested in the animals that we live closely with, whether it's our pets or whether it's a mule that is delivering anti-aircraft missiles in Afghanistan. The idea that we've crossed species to create some sort of agreement that we are going to work together. To me, it's a source of endless fascination, or animals that are meant to be wild that we have brought into our sphere, and then we're stuck with the problem of what do you do with that?
Well, I guess this is what I innately as a child didn't understand. Whatever chaos was in the house, I didn't understand, why is there also a dog here?
Right.
Where did that come from?
Right. Although occasionally the dog is the quiet place in the household and the place with the least complicated emotional baggage that, you know, you come home, your dog licks you, whether you've done good or bad things that day out in the world. So there is a simplicity to our relationship with animals.
What was the hardest animal to have? I half expect to read soon that you're going to have a panda bear in your backyard.
Oh my God, I would love that. actually, in a way, the hardest was having chickens, not because they're hard to take care of, but because everyone in the natural world likes chicken. And it's the only animal I've ever had that I many times had killed by other animals.
So I remember in your essay, The It Bird, you said that you could not kill and eat a sickly chicken. You had to take it to the vet.
Yes, this was the moment where, you know, I fancied myself a farmer. I was having my Ava Gabor Green Acres moment of living up in the country and thinking, well, I'm a farmer. You know, I go and get hay and feed. And then my chicken developed a neurological ailment. She couldn't stand up. She wasn't eating. And I asked a neighbor who was a longtime resident of this was the Hudson Valley of New York, and he was a guy who had lived up there forever. And I said, what should I do? My chicken's sick. And he made a motion that indicated the wringing of the neck of the chicken.
That's what I would have thought.
Yeah, which is you have a sick chicken, you kill it. But being a suburban girl who really had only experienced interacting with animals as pets, I thought, I'm not killing her. I'm going to seek the finest medical attention. And I took her to the vet who—
I got to ask you, how much did the veterinary care of the sick chicken cost?
Well, I am going to withhold that answer because it's a source of conflict with me and my husband, who pointed out the price of rotisserie chicken at the supermarket versus the price of taking care of my chicken. And there was really nothing to do for her, so I had her euthanized. And again, this was something where my husband could not believe that I was paying $150 to euthanize my chicken.
Susan, I've always thought of you as a writer who's is a comic writer, but very cunning about it. In other words, you use your comic skills when needed, or it comes and it goes. Like your book on the library in Los Angeles, obviously, is not a comic subject. And not all these pieces on animals are innately comic. Talk to me about the role in your writing life of comic voice as opposed to a more, you know, serious narrative voice.
First of all, you know, I think what you try to do as a writer is to move ever closer to your actual authentic voice as a person. And I like making jokes. I like seeing the irony in things. And even things that are very serious, I invariably find some twist of the story that gives me a moment of laughter or at least a chuckle.
And it seems to happen in all your work. In The Orchid Thief, in your book on Rin Tin Tin, the serious has comic undertones and the comic has serious meaning at the moments you want it. So in the essay, The It Bird, you write, many philosophers, including John Berger, maintain that what we consider modernity began at the moment when we no longer relied on animals for utility. We didn't ride them or raise them or milk them, and they were absent from daily life except as ornaments. So are these animals ornaments, really? And ornaments of what?
we're attracted to animals in part as texture. There's a pleasure in having your eye land on a living being that's not a person. There's a great pleasure in communicating in some wordless way with another species. And, you know, whether you like animals or not, there is something kind of miraculous and marvelous about being able to cross the divide of species and communicate. And then there's some animals that we like just because they're amazing to look at. And when we were living on our farm, my husband coined the phrase landscape animals because he felt like there, part of the reason for having some animals was that you could look out and see them and they were an attractive part of the landscape, a little bit like kinetic sculpture. And I do think that, you know, there's a way you collect animals when you live in the country and you have enough space for them that's a bit kind of antic and crazy because why not, like, bring a donkey home? And,
and Susan, I have to tell you, as an editor and you as a writer, we every Tuesday afternoon at 4 o'clock, we have an ideas meeting. And people come to the meeting with three ideas. And you know, we should do more about the war in Afghanistan, or we should write a profile of this person or that person, or whatever it might be. I can't ever think of an instance where somebody came in with what I would call a Susan Orlean type idea. And I guess the silliest question that writers get or songwriters get or whatever it might be is, where do you get your ideas? But I've got to ask you, where do they come from?
It's flotsam and jetsam. It's the sign hanging on a telephone pole. It's an overheard conversation. It's a magazine, a specialty magazine that mentions some odd thing. And it's burr that gets stuck on your jacket and it just clings. And you think, wow, what is that? What? I need to know more about that. And it can be so random. I mean, when I think about the story that I did about taxidermy, I was visiting a friend who's an artist, a painter, and he had a taxidermy catalog for taxidermy supplies. I love gear, and I love any hobby that has a lot of gear. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, you can order bear noses. Like, that's amazing. And I said, oh, my God, how could there be a 5-inch thick taxidermy supply catalog? I mean, aren't there only 2 or 3 taxidermists in the world? And I got home that night and thought, wait, I'm still convinced there are only like 3 taxidermists in the United States. So I Googled taxidermy and I got up like 11 million hits. And the first thing that popped up was that the world taxidermy championships were coming up in a week or two. And, you know, to me, it's like...
That's mana from heaven.
Yes, like the top half of my skull just lifted off. And I'll never forget because I came running into the office the next day and I didn't have any idea of what the story was about. And I said, can I cover the world taxidermy championships? And you said, let me think if I've already assigned that to someone.
Susan Orlean, thank you. The book is On Animals, in case you haven't guessed. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
That's our program for today. I'm David Remnick. Thank you for joining us. Hope you have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.